before you drink. What you get isn't always what you think.
Beers of Alaska, beer on the last frontier. Beers of Alaska, learn about them here.
Well, don't settle for the first, for it might be the worst.
Hello and welcome to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. As always, thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. So we've got a lot of good stuff for you this month. Let's get right into beer news. The bad news from COVID-19 keeps on coming. On June 29th, the Brewers Association, of which the American Home Brewers Association is a part, announced that it had lost nearly 70% of its annual revenue due to the cancellation of all of its 2020 events. Due to the budget shortfalls, Gary Glass, the director of the American Home Brewers Association, was terminated after a 20-year tenure. Going forward, Brewers Association Vice President of Staff Development Ryan Farrell will lead the AHA. This comes after other staff reductions announced in the late spring. On Monday, July 20th, the Brewers Association addressed criticism of its handling of racist actions by breweries within its membership. In an email to members entitled Bylaw and Governance Update, President and CEO Bob Peace wrote that the BA had heard the criticism and its silence did not mean the calls to action had gone unheard. Our limited public response to date has not been sufficient for many, but it does not equate to apathy, he wrote. Peace explained that the association's bylaws, as currently written, do not include a mechanism for revoking a brewery's membership or a code of conduct for its member breweries. However, Peace said that the BA staff, board of directors, and governance committee had been working with the organization's diversity committee to correct the bylaw and governance document gaps. Those efforts include updated bylaws, the introduction of a code of conduct, and a complaint process. In his email, Peace wrote that the BA had completed a draft of updated bylaws that would include the ability to remove a member brewery from the organization. The draft of the bylaws will be circulated to Brewers Association voting members in the next week for feedback during a 20-day comment period. The Brewers Association is also drafting language for a member code of conduct, as well as a complaint and review process that will be reviewed by an ad hoc group of board and committee members. Those documents are expected to be shared with the members in the coming month, Peace wrote. On the bright side, Cooper Landing Brewing Company opened for business in its new location on Friday, July 17th. On July 9th, 2020, the Federal Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, or TTB, announced a settlement with Anheuser-Busch. While the settlement, called an offer in compromise in the language of TTB, allows Anheuser-Busch to admit no wrongdoing, the published, though redacted, settlement papers include factual allegations of how the federal agency believes Anheuser-Busch violated federal trade practice laws. Anheuser-Busch also paid a price for the settlement, paying $5 million in fines and serving short suspensions of its federal importer and wholesaler permits at several locations in Colorado. Federal law prohibits exclusive outlet arrangements, and the federal Tied House law presumptively prohibits, among other things, a brewer, importer, or wholesaler from providing a retailer with money, equipment, suppliers, services, or other things of value in order to induce the retailer to purchase the seller's product. Federal regulations provide a list of permitted goods and services that can be supplied, but those do not address writing big checks for sponsorships. In addition, in order to make a tied house case, the government must show that the money or other thing of value inducement led to the exclusion of competing products. Courts have interpreted this exclusion element as requiring the government to show that the practice threatened or could threaten the retailer's independence. In the abstract and statement that the TTB publishes when announcing any settlement, along with the July 9th press release on the settlement with Anheuser-Busch, TTB alleged, among other things, that Anheuser-Busch violated the law by entering into sponsorship agreements with various entities in sports and entertainment industries, requiring concessionaires and other retailers to purchase Anheuser-Busch malt beverages and prohibiting them from purchasing specific competitor brands, and inducing sports industries concessionaires to purchase Anheuser-Busch malt beverages by furnishing fixtures, equipment, and services. In short, the facts alleged by the government support what many craft brewers have long suspected. Anheuser-Busch has used its clout as a sponsor of various teams and resorts to force its products on the public and exclude competitors from venues around the country. Girdwood Brewing Company's No Woman, No Cryo was recently selected as one of the top 112 IPAs in the country by Craft Beer and Brewing magazine. The Brewers Association selected Bear Paw River Brewing and Arcos Brewery as in the top 10 individual taproom breweries for the Pacific Northwest region, with Bear Paw River being chosen as number 7 and Arcos as number 9. A new brewery in Fairbanks, Latitude 65 Brewing Company, is moving toward opening. It took delivery of tanks and equipment in late June and expects to open in a couple of months. That's it for this month's beer news. We'll be right back with our next segment. This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. In this month's feature segment, we're going to talk about cask conditioning. During last month's live call-in show, a lady caller asked a question about what makes British beer taste so unique. I tried to give her the best off-the-cuff answer that I could manage, but in thinking about it since then, I decided that I really hadn't done justice to such a broad and excellent topic. Therefore, in this month's feature segment, I want to talk in detail about what I think is the key component in making British beer the marvel that it is: cask conditioning. So what is cask conditioning? Put simply, it's a process in which draft beer leaves the brewery still retaining live yeast in order to enable a secondary fermentation to take place in the cask in the cellar of the receiving pub. In other words, the beer leaves the brewery not yet ready to drink. It reaches its mature, ready to be consumed stage at the pub. Beer that is cask conditioned is neither filtered nor pasteurized and is often called cask ale, real ale, or in Britain, traditional ale. Conditioning is a complex business, and the term covers chemical, biological, and physical changes occurring from when the beer leaves the fermenting vessel in the brewery and is racked into a cask up to the time it is dispensed by one of several methods from the cask into a glass ready to be served to the drinker. Achieving the correct condition for a cask-conditioned beer is a skilled job usually performed by the publican or the cellar man. Most of this activity takes place in the pub cellar. Some beers have a small amount of sugar solution, called primings, added to produce natural carbonation and help create the beer's foam. The residual yeast that is left in the beer after it's transferred to the cask will continue changing the sugar into alcohol and produce carbon dioxide. The cask must be vented during conditioning by using a soft spile that allows excess gas to escape. Contrary to much foreign opinion, cask-conditioned beer should not be flat. A certain amount of carbon dioxide must be retained in the beer to give it liveliness on the palate. This is the condition sought by the cellar man, and without it, the beer can become flat and lifeless. The flavor of the beer is materially affected by this secondary fermentation. The period of time required for conditioning will vary according to the style, strength, and brand of the beer, and it is usual for breweries to advise publicans as to what conditioning period is recommended and at what temperature. In practice, it can vary widely from as little as 24 hours to as much as 16 days, with the beer being kept between 55 and 57 degrees Fahrenheit. The beer goes through a stage known as dropping bright, which is the settling of the yeast and proteins to the bottom of the cask, leaving the beer perfectly clear. This task is accomplished by adding finings to the beer that bind with the sediment and carry it to the bottom of the cask. Traditionally, isinglass is used as finings. Improbably enough, it is made from the swim bladders of fish, such as sturgeon. Isinglass has been processed so as to do its job without adding any flavors to the beer. Some brewers, such as Guinness, have replaced isinglass with non-organic finings in order to produce beer acceptable to vegans. Other changes take place during the maturation period in the cask. The beer can attain flavor from dry hops. These are hops added directly to the cask as it is being filled, mainly for increased hop aroma. Strong beers require long periods of maturation, and these casks are often stored for weeks or months at the brewery before being released to the pubs. The method of dispensing beer from a cask into the glass can vary widely and sometimes reflects regional taste. Unlike what the British call keg beer and Americans think of as draft beer, cask-conditioned beers do not have external carbon dioxide pressure applied, so they will not simply flow when a tap is opened. The most common way to serve a cask-conditioned beer is by the use of a beer engine, a hand-operated hydraulic pump that draws beer from a cask in the cellar up to the bar. It's commonly called a hand pump or a hand pull. The requirement for a head on the beer is also a constant, but the size and density of the foam desired depends on geography. In Yorkshire, in the north of England, a tight, creamy head is required. In Teesside, to the northeast, it should be large and loose, and in most of the rest of England and Wales, a narrow head, known as a string of beads, is the ideal. Besides hand pumps, electric metered and free flow systems are used, though not in the north, as they cannot produce the sort of head popular there. Finally, there is the age-old system of gravity dispense, where the beer runs from a simple tap in the cask into a glass or jug. This was the only method prior to the invention of the beer engine in 1797. While the inconvenience of this method is obvious, some publicans prefer its traditional aspect. The cask can literally be set directly on the bar and kept cool with a refrigerated blanket. As you can see from all of the above, British ale is not so much a style of beer as a complete beer production system, ranging from the breweries that produce the beer to the pub cellars where it is matured to the point of perfection, to the unique means of dispensing it to the customer. You can't truly have cask ale without pubs, and you can't have a traditional pub without craft ale. This complex symbiosis is the main reason why efforts to transplant genuine cask-conditioned beers into the U.S. have been less than successful. We lack the pub infrastructure and the cultural values that are vital to underpinning something so fragile and complex as cask conditioning. That's not to say you won't find occasional examples, if you are alert to them. Here on the peninsula, St. Elias Brewing Company has a beer engine or hand pump installed. Sadly, it's almost never used, as owner Zach Henry has learned from several attempts that most folks around here have no idea what cask-conditioned beer is and won't order it if it is on offer. Up in Anchorage, Glacier Brew House also has a single hand pump and usually has one cask-conditioned beer on offer, though I suspect they sell more of it to tourists than they do to Alaskans. Finally, some breweries do tap small casks for special events, such as Midnight Sun Brewing's First Firkin Friday. A firkin is a type of small cask, and on the first Friday of the month, the brewery often holds an event that includes hammering a tap into a firkin of one of its regular beers, often modified in some way, to create a unique experience. Besides those few and far between opportunities, you'll likely have to travel to Britain to experience cask-conditioned ale in its true glory. Having lived in London myself for 3 years, I can honestly say that there is no better beer experience in the world than enjoying a properly conditioned pint of cask ale in a traditional British pub. That's it for this month's feature. We'll be right back with our next segment. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. We're going to talk about women in brewing. For the last few decades in the United States, beer has been thought of as primarily a drink for men. The accepted wisdom was that women preferred wine or cocktails while men downed the six-packs. It's strange that beer has come to be seen as such a masculine beverage when, for centuries, brewing was the responsibility of women. The first written beer recipe is considered to be the Hymn to Ninkasi, circa 1800 BC. Ninkasi was the Sumerian goddess, note the goddess, not the god, of beer, and the Sumerians were one of the first peoples who left us hard evidence of beer drinking. Beer predates that recipe, though. Archaeologists have placed the first fermented beverage consumption at roughly 9,000 years ago, and the first signs of beer specifically about 4,000 years later. As I've discussed on past shows, many believe beer propelled the shift from Paleolithic to Neolithic civilization when hunter-gatherers realized they'd have to settle in one place to reliably harvest grain. Right from the start, brewing, a kitchen task, was woman's work. Both the Sumerians and the Egyptians praised beer goddesses and associated brewing with women. In addition to Ninkasi as a woman to look up to, the Sumerians also had Kubaba. She is the only woman on the Sumerians' list of kings, and she earned her ruling role not through birth, but through her work as a brewer. The Egyptians worshipped goddess of beer Menkaut and celebrated the sun god Ra's daughter, Sekhmet, whose bloodthirsty ways were calmed by beers. Even as beer became a product to sell, women remained in charge. Patty Hamrick, a writer with a master's in archaeological anthropology, teaches a class called The Archaeology of Beer. She points to the Babylonian Code of Hammurabi from Mesopotamia, one of the civilization's first set of written laws, as evidence of women's authority in beer. Quote, "The Babylonian language is a gendered language, and every time a law is listed for anything having to do with a tavern, like not overcharging for beer, every mention of a tavern owner uses she," Hamrick said. The concept of an alewife emerged around the 5th century AD. Women were making large volumes of beer for their families and often had a surplus, so they'd signal that they had extra beer for sale by placing greenery over their doors or in some cases a broom. Alewives sometimes also stood on corners to advertise, wearing tall hats, and had cats to chase the pests that ate their grain. It's theorized that the alewife image gave way to our traditional witch image. Some alewives, or brewsters, to use a female term for brewers, even set up rough versions of bars in their homes. Hamrick places the shift of brewing from women to men around the development of brewing guilds. The earliest guild was founded in London around 1200, and they existed more widely by the 1500s and were responsible for pushing women out of commercial brewing. Quote, "This is when we begin to see people making rules for how a beer is brewed, and the use of hops is becoming prevalent, so beer would last longer and you could make larger quantities at a time and ship it to different cities and countries," Hamrick said. "Beer was becoming larger scale than before," end quote. While hops and their preservative powers were the beginning of the end for women's dominance in brewing, it's believed to be a woman who first wrote about their scientific properties, says Jeffrey Pilcher, author and professor of food studies at the University of Toronto, Scarborough. Benedictine abbess Hildegard of Bingen was a brewer and a herbalist who described using hops in beer in the 12th century AD. When beer grew from a cottage industry to a big business with an import-export trade, it was no longer in the household domain. In addition to guilds, government officials set rules to take advantage of beer's selling power. In Bruges, the first association of brewery workers met in 1447 to protect themselves from, quote, "innkeeper, woman, and provost." The innkeeper was their customer, the woman was their competitor, and the provost was the government taxman. The Industrial Revolution further improved the efficiency of brewing and shipping beer worldwide. By the dawn of the 20th century, beer production and subsequently beer consumption was firmly in the hands of men. Quote, "Beer became known as a man's beverage because it was made by men," says Terry Fahrendorf, a brewmaster for three decades and founder of the Pink Boots Society, an organization for women in the beer industry. The teamwork that had existed earlier in beer production went away, and women had a new image, demure, virginal, married. Suddenly, it may not have been so ladylike to have a beer. End quote. When Western women began entering the workforce en masse during the 1960s and 1970s, breweries became an option for employment. It's been a struggle to overcome consumer attitudes and tone-deaf marketing campaigns, from objectifying women to suggesting that they need their own special beer, but real change is happening, especially in more recent years. Quote, "There are many women in the beer industry today, exponentially more than when I began my career," says Tonya Cornett, research and development brewmaster at 10 Barrel Brewing in Bend, Oregon. "Women are plugging along and making a significant impact. Most female brewers I know want to be known for the quality of the beer they make, that rather than constantly focusing on the fact that they are female." End quote. Statistics are hard to come by, but a study by a Stanford University research team found that 20% of American breweries opened in 2014 had a female co-founder. Only 2% were exclusively female-owned. Furthermore, only 4% of the breweries they coded had a female head brewer or brewmaster. It's slow but steady going, and good news isn't hard to find. In 2014, Belgium got its first female Trappist brewmaster. More women are opening breweries in America's booming craft industry, and the range of jobs women are exploring in beer is expanding. On a consumer level, a recent Brewers Association study found 31% of craft beer drinkers are women, up from 29% in 2015. Women's growth in today's industry is evident in the ever-increasing membership of the Pink Boots Society. The organization started as a list of all the female brewers founder Terry Fahrendorf met or heard about on a cross-country brewing trip in 2007. There were 60 people on her first list and 16 brewers and 6 beer writers at the first Pink Boots Society meeting in 2008. The society now has 2,090 members, 72 state chapters, and 13 international chapters, and they are growing at a rate of 157 new members per month. Hopefully, understanding the rich history of women in brewing will inspire the young women of today and encourage them to continue creating careers for themselves in the craft brewing industry, both around the world and here in Alaska. Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. I'm your host, Bill Howell. During my featured segment earlier in the show, I talked about cask-conditioned beers. For this month's style section, I want to talk about a particular British beer style, the Extra Special Bitter, or ESB. If you're going to talk about ESBs, you really must talk about Fuller's ESB. There are a couple of obvious reasons for this. First and foremost, Fuller's originated the style, and in Britain it holds the trademark of that name, much as Anchor Brewing holds the trademark for steam beers in the United States. Fuller's is the last old ale brewery standing in London, at one time the most important brewing city in the world. Fuller's ESB, for its part, was such an important beer to American brewers during the late 1970s revival that it became a model for many of the American ales that would soon populate brewpubs across the country. Beyond that, it's just a fantastic beer and one of the most decorated in Britain. Extra Special Bitter is a bit of an oddball in British terms. Among traditional cask ales, low alcohol bitters, usually somewhat below to somewhat above 4%, are the standards. The weakest are just plain bitter, while those coming in above 4% are usually called best bitters. A much rarer category is strong bitter, which might float up to around 5%. Fuller's strong bitter, styled Extra Special, is even stronger than that, 5.5% on draft, 5.9% in the bottle. In British terms, that was until recently a very strong beer. It makes sense that this was the first British ale Americans discovered. With more hops and alcohol, it traveled better than the low-alcohol bitters. I can recall tasting bottle versions of it in the late 80s, and its bitterness seemed notably aggressive, at least for the time. I'm not sure what it was then, but it's currently around 35 IBUs, produced by a complex hop recipe that includes Challenger, Goldings, North Down, and Target varieties, with Goldings being used to dry hop in the fermentation vessel. Compared to the more subtle flavors in regular bitters, it's bold and flashy. It's no surprise that Americans liked it. After all, if an American were going to brew a style of British beer, they would naturally gravitate to the one called Extra Special, particularly if it had more flavor and oomph. Consequently, for decades, ESB was what most American breweries called their bitter. If they had two, they didn't realize the one they called bitter was actually a best bitter. And if they had an ESB, they didn't realize that that's not what English brewers called their styles. They assumed that all strong bitters were extra special, not realizing it was a product name unique to Fuller's. Thus, they elevated Fuller's by creating the style of ESB. In the 1980s and 90s, Fuller's ESB may have been more famous in the U.S. than Britain. To make its ESB, Fuller's conducts one of the more remarkable practices in the world, party guile brewing. It's a process that dates back centuries and is almost entirely extinct. It's so obscure now that most people misunderstand how it works. The idea is to pull multiple worts off a single mash, boil them as usual, and then blend them back together to get beers of different strengths. Most people glean the first two steps, but not the third, believing that each guile produces a single beer. The system was made obsolete when breweries started sparging or washing their sugars from the grain bed with water so that a single mash produced a single wort. Fuller's party guile works like this. They begin with a grist of 97% pale English spring malt and 3% light crystal. For efficiency, Fuller's uses two mash tuns, staggered, so one is draining while the other one rests during conversion. Brewers take the first runnings from one mash of strong wort and then follow it with the second mash tun, combining the strong worts from both mashes in the same kettle. Next, they run weak worts from both mash tuns into a second kettle. The runnings at the end of the first mash are barely more than water. The wort has a gravity of just over 1 Plato, or 1.005. So again, both strong worts go into the same kettle, and both weak worts go into a second, different kettle. The boiling process for both worts is the same, 60 minutes with two hop additions, one at the start of the boil, one with 5 minutes left. Of course, the strong wort gets twice as many hops as the weak one for obvious reasons, but they are the same varieties in the same proportions. Only once the worts have cooled and pitched with yeast do they begin to combine them to get the beers they want. Before Chiswick Bitter was demoted from the regular line, the brewery could produce it, London Pride, ESB, and when needed, Golden Pride, from just these two worts. That means Fuller's could produce any one of four different beers from the same brewing process. As a Romantic American, I like to think this process accounts for at least some of the unique character in ESB. Fuller's ESB is a complex and robust beer. It shows a profusion of rich malt, orangey fruit, and peppery hops in the nose, with a full-bodied attack of juicy malt, orange peel, and bitter hop resins on the palate. The complex and lingering finish is beautifully balanced between malt, hops, and tangy fruit, finally becoming dry with a bitter hop resin note. Do these qualities come from the process? I'm hesitant to make that claim. Too often I've gone looking for special flavors in beer and found them whether they exist or not. On the other hand, this is what happens when you have a decades-long relationship with a beer you adore. It may be the very definition of a classic, a beer so good and enduring that drinkers pour into it the very meaning that makes it a classic. The fact that Fuller's ESB is made through this strange, ancient process helps support its claim to being a truly classic beer. Sadly, while beers in this style were once the mainstay of many an American brewery or brew pub, these days they have fallen out of favor, especially with the growing popularity of India Pale Ales. At one time or another, many of the breweries in Alaska produced ESBs regularly, but no longer. The larger bottle shops in Anchorage occasionally have beers from Fuller's on offer, though not as often as I would like, and brew pubs around the state brew a one-off batch every now and then. If you'd like to taste an ESB, short of traveling to Britain or brewing your own, my best advice is to watch the menu at your local brew pub for one of these offerings. It's a shame that ESBs have become so rare, given both their role in the history of American craft brewing and their outstanding flavor and drinkability. We'll be right back with our next segment. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, Bill Howell, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.